This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening, and welcome to the Late Late Show with Sean McKay. Tonight, special guest Katie Prange. I hope that's the way you say the last name. And we're going to be talking about everything academic writing, and hopefully take lots away from it, and that will help me in my school, and hopefully help you in your school too. That's on Teachers Talk Radio tonight.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
So, good evening, and welcome to the Late Late Show with Sean McKay, with my special guest, Katie Prange. Katie, how are you? How are things over there in Illinois?
Things are good over here. How about over there in the UK?
It's quite wet over here at the moment. Well, in Leicestershire it is anyway. We've got a lot of kind of... It can't decide whether or not it wants to rain or sunshine at the moment, which is quite nice for the greenery, I suppose, but not really nice when you're trying to walk between sites when you're in school. So let's start the show then, and we'll start off with the first question, which is the same question that I ask with every single person that comes on here. So what is your favourite book and why?
Okay, I looked at this as a book I read as a child. To be A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline Lengel. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. And it was just one of those books that helped me to understand that I could be more than I thought I could, that I could do more than I thought I could.
That's fantastic. So what's it about? What has it got in it?
The book is about just a sister and her little brother, and how they go out and figure out who they are, and in the process they find their father, and they come, you know, and they come back home and rejoin their whole family. And I don't know, it's just kind of an interesting coming of age novel, I think.
Yeah, coming of age novels, I love those ones. But the kind of, I also really like the Bildungsroman novels, the ones that kind of start off and follow a child kind of going all the way through. I think that's some of the best novels you can actually have. But I love those kind of the coming of age ones where they kind of grow up and do that. That's fantastic. So, great novel. Lovely to hear that one. I might have to try and find that one myself and have a look. So can you then tell us a little bit about yourself and about your context, where you're coming from, for the people here?
Yes, rural town. I teach in a small rural school in an area that used to be full of coal mines.
Yeah, okay.
It's actually a very poor area, you know, a fairly underprivileged area now. And the kids are awesome. I love teaching there. I love the faculty. I do all the dual credit English classes, meaning I teach all the classes where the kids get high school credit and college credit at the same time.
Okay. Obviously, we're in the UK here. Can you tell me a little bit about the kind of the difference between the school credit and the college credit? It's kind of something I don't know very much about.
Okay. Well, as a junior or a senior in school, kids can take, if their grades are good, they can take a class in high school. And then they earn not only high school credit, but they also earn credit from a local university. Okay. And so I teach the same class they do at the local university. I just teach it in the high school.
Oh, okay.
And so So the kids earn. And so it's a less expensive way for them to try to get to college and earn some college credits.
Okay. That sounds great. Okay. Right then, let's get down to writing. So my first question is in terms of the writing section is quite a big one, I think. It's certainly something that I have an opinion on. Do you think that reading is one key to really good writing?
100%.
Okay.
100%, I do. And I see it in my students when they are, we always, whatever essay we are working on, I find that same type of essay for them to use as a model. And we read through it and we dissect it and we take it apart and we talk about all of the different elements of the essay so that they can work on trying to incorporate some of those into their writing.
Okay, cool. So,
oh no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, is there any particular kind of reading that you think makes a person's writing better, or is it just kind of any reading at all?
I do assign different types of novels for them to read, just so they can get outside reading and other stories. But I also think it's very important that whatever type of essay you are writing, because I'm very structured in the essays that I teach, that you also see that type of structure essay in your writing. But I will say that any reading is going to help your writing, because looking at other styles and what people do and how they introduce conversation or how they introduce material, that's all very important. And people, students, struggle to do that. And so I think they need to see examples of it in a variety of forms.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I certainly see with my students, the students who are much greater readers are the people also with the highest kind of range of vocabulary. And so therefore, a lot of the academic writing that they have is much more fluent, much more communicative, because they have that range of vocabulary that's going to help them to explain and communicate the meanings of what they actually are trying to say as well, I think. Would you agree?
Yes, I would definitely agree.
Okay, 100%. Fabulous. Brilliant.
Sorry.
So there's a bit of a delay, I think. So I'm trying to leave a little bit of space so that you can get there.
No, I want to give one example from teaching just this week. I have this one English class where the kids have to do almost all nonfiction reading.
Yep.
Which is really hard. So I struggle to find things that are going to be of interest to them. But one of the books we're reading, the kids are very interested in. But I had one student just yesterday go, "Mrs. Prangy, I have learned 15 new words this week. And here they are." And he just starts listing the words off that he has learned. And he's looked them all up and he found the definition and he starts using them in sentences or asking me a little bit about them. And that is fabulous. I love when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the greatest things about teaching is when you see that kind of learning coming into the classroom, and you see that some of the kind of independent learning and that they've done, and they become really happy about it and really enthusiastic. And you can do the same thing, I think.
No, we do all kinds of, like I said, different reading. Like, so right now the kids are reading a novel. Well, it's a novel. It's a true story by a journalist about her experiences interviewing some subjects about what they did when they were younger. And so we're looking about nature versus nurture. So we did a whole lot of background, and now they're reading the novel, and it's interesting all the connections that they make. And I'm kind of excited to see what they do with the next paper that we assign over this.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly wonderful when they begin to kind of really focus on kind of the vocabulary and the things that they want to do in their writing and kind of how they are going to explore that learning. So my next question then, and hopefully we can look at this one in a lot of detail. What, in your opinion, is the most important thing to think about when it comes to writing?
I think for my students, I always stress to them to not worry about their first draft and what they're putting down on paper first. Most of my students they think that what they put down on paper is what they have to turn in, like what they first put down.
Yeah.
And that is a real hurdle for them to get over. And so when I teach, and I know this is one of your further questions, when I teach, I teach about the process. And so I very much make them stick to their process, and they learn so much. And I think the most important thing that they learn is what they start with is not necessarily what they end with.
Right. Okay. And how would that look in kind of a classroom when you said about what they start with isn't necessarily always at the end with? Do they often, like with my students, for instance, they don't want to do more than one draft. It's one of the hurdles that I find in my English class is trying to get them to teach that editing process, to show them that editing doesn't have to be rewriting the entire thing. It's just finding particular bits of it and making it better. I mean, what would you say to that?
So especially in my English 4 honors, so in my upper level class, we go through every paper, we go through a process. We start with brainstorming and pre-writing, and then we move to outlining, and then we move slowly into the draft. And if we're doing sources, we do our research prior to that. But we go through a step-by-step process. They don't even start the paper, usually until we do 11 papers in my one class. They don't start writing a paper until like week 2.
Right. Okay.
And then for editing, they do a peer editing, they do a revision. They do a lot of changes before they ever turn their paper, you know, before they turn their final draft into me. But it's all this, it's the process that I have set up.
Yeah.
And they, and like you said, they balk at it at first. They do not like it. They argue with me, not argue, you know, but they talk about how they don't need to do this. But then by the end of the first semester, they have figured out that what they're doing makes their writing better. But I'm very strict with the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll come back to some of the things because I want to talk to you about some of the things you just talked about in a second.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR 2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
So we're back again after that. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, the thing that you said in part of that process was brainstorming ideas. Now, in terms of kind of an academic essay, what sort of things would you look for in that brainstorming? Do you brainstorm the question they're going to answer, or is it the brainstorm some of the things that they might include in it, like the terminology? How does that brainstorming work?
Well, it's different with every essay that I do, and we start with the essential question. I start with them. Sometimes I start with just like a brain dump with the essential question that they have to answer. And so they just literally write for like 5 or 10 minutes and then they share what they have written. And then we go through a series of steps in our pre-writing to where they are trying to figure out what they want to write about, what they want to say. They want to answer like the how and the why questions. They want to come up with their research question and then their thesis. But it is a strict process because as they go through their pre-writing, I need them to figure out the purpose of their essay, who their audience is, what they want their audience to learn, and why they have this specific audience and what they think the audience knows and what they need to know. So that leads to what kind of terminology you use. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that I'm always their audience, but they have to figure out what I know about whatever they're talking about and whether I'm experienced in what they're talking about. So that does lead to what terminology they do use in their essay.
Yeah.
If we're talking about specific subjects.
Yeah. Do you find it's quite hard? Because I don't know about you. I mean, obviously as English teachers, as teachers in general, we have a certain number of assessments that we have to do over the course of the year. And one of the things that I found is that the process that I have to go through, the same as this kind of process that you have to go through, which we'll talk about in a sec. Do you find it I don't know, hard, frustrating, that I don't know whether your children are the same as mine, but mine tend to forget. So the next time we come to do an essay, you have to reteach that whole kind of process again, because it's like they seem to have forgotten it. It's as if I didn't actually teach it. I don't know what you think.
Oh, that happens. That happens all the time. And so I try to be very clear on my directions. And you're right. Sometimes I do have to reteach the concepts that I want them to learn. But I do think in my English, you know, this is the class I always think about, the English 4, because we write 11 essays, that by the time they've written essay, you know, 3 or 4, they're starting to get down what my expectations are. And they're starting to get better at, if they don't remember something, they go look it up first and try to figure it out. And then they ask me what they don't know, because that's what I always send them back. Instead of just telling them again, I always send them back to.
Yeah. So do you think then that when you say you send them back, is it that high expectation of their writing, of the process of that writing, that makes, by the time they get to like the third or fourth one, that they've got that process and they're starting to learn it? Is it also that teachers have to have high expectations of their pupils and their writing? So like, do send them back, do make them go back if it's not good enough, and keep going so that they have a sense of resilience as well?
Oh, I 100% agree. When kids come in to take my class, they know that I do have, when you talk about those high expectations, I do have those high expectations, and they want to meet them. That's what they want to do. And it's a challenge for them. And that's what we talk about the whole, you know, basically the whole year. We talk about what a challenge it is to take an upper level English class and to be successful in it. And they, a lot of them struggle, and which is not a bad thing. And we talk about that. We talk about the struggle, and we talk about how that's actually a good thing. And that means they're learning. If it were easy, there would be no reason for me to teach it. You need to struggle through this. And I think for me, not to extend on this, but I do think for me, because they know that I do write and I do publish, they know that I go through, they know I go through that same process. And so I share the things that I do in my writing and the struggles that I have in my writing. And they realize that it's not like a new writer thing, you know, that it's just a thing about writing. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That's great. Some great answers there. So my next question then, and I don't know whether this is kind of a long answer one or a short answer one, but what do you think is the difference between academic and kind of creative writing?
Well, I don't do a ton of creative writing. I do some personal writing where they can, I do some writing where they can use first person. So I can kind of address it that way. Academic writing, I really work with them on their sources, on introducing their sources, and on the structure. Because I think there's a structure to academic writing, and there's a level of language that students have to have, and there's a clarity that needs to be there. And so we work a lot on that with academic writing. And I think the difference between that and other forms, whether it be creative writing or narrative writing or whatever, is that I'm going to say that level of language, because I allow them in their descriptive or their narrative writing to use more of their colloquial language and to be able to express themselves the way they want to, versus the academic writing, which they have to like know contractions and they have to properly introduce everything. But I want them to learn the difference, because there is a stark difference in the two.
No, absolutely. I certainly agree with one of the things when you said about the structure of academic writing. And I think when we come to that, because obviously my next question is coming up on that one, but it is very, very structured. You follow a complete process going through. And I think because I do teach creative writing, it's part of the syllabus in England. It's one of the things that I don't think we teach enough in terms of creative writing. I teach so much structure for academic writing. And when it comes to essays that we do in terms of creative writing, we don't teach them how to link the paragraphs the same way that we do in terms of academic writing. And certainly I agree with you, the language in creative writing is totally different to the language of an essay that they have to do. It's far more formal. And yes, you talked about, you know, the lack of contractions and that sense of structure. Totally, it's so simple. And yet you kind of said it, and it sprung loads of new ideas. I was scribbling away loads of notes as you were as you were talking, because it kind of strikes you in the face, and you think I'm not teaching structure enough in creative writing. But that's a great way of looking at it. The language and the structure of it is totally different.
I know, and I think you can be. I allow the kids. I wish I could teach more creative writing. Because, you know, what we want the kids to be able to do, what we want students to do, is to be able to express themselves on a piece of paper. And I think one of the easiest ways to first do that is to allow them to do that kind of in their language, and then maybe learn to transition over to the academic writing. So I wish I got to do more creative. Just the way our syllabus is structured, and the, you know, because I get mine from the college. The way it's structured, I don't have that complete luxury. So,
yeah.
Which makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we find with the creative writing, and it enhances in a certain respect the academic writing, because by doing the process yourself, by thinking about what your intent is, what the purpose is, how you're trying to affect the audience, that also affects how they see someone else's pieces of writing, because then they, if they're doing that process themselves, they're able to see how an actual author might be doing a similar thing. That's one of the things that I found.
Yeah, I do like to link whatever, you know, and I think you can do it more easily with creative writing, but I do like to link whatever assignment I have to a piece of real writing, you know, to a piece of published writing that mimics that, so kids can look at what the, you know, what other authors do, and then how they can work to implement some of that into their writing using their own voice.
Oh, absolutely. So that structure part brings me really nicely onto my next question, which is there a particular structure? And I know that you've actually answered this in part a little bit earlier. So is there a particular structure that you use when you teach essay writing? So for instance, we've got a number of different ones that we use in terms of literature essay writing, such as P, which is point evidence analysis, or PEASL, which is point evidence analysis, zoom in, analyze, link back to the question. So do you have a particular kind of structure that you use? And if you do, why do you think it's so effective?
The structures we use, I've worked at schools where we've had to use certain structures to teach writing. But where I am now, we generally teach the pair, you know, we work with ICE, introduce, cite, explain.
Yeah.
With that. So that kind of leads into, that kind of goes with your P, the point evidence and analysis. Yeah. It's a similar type of, however, when I teach, I look at each part separately. Like I talk about the introduction as its own, you know, as its own piece, where you have your hook, background, thesis statement. And then yeah. I talk about the body paragraphs, obviously, where you're going to introduce and cite and explain all of the borrowed material that you're going to put in. But I try to put together how you lead into, you know, transition into the paragraphs with your topic sentences, how all of the support and explanatory sentences work, and how they lead into the conclusion sentence. So I don't necessarily use structures like you do, other than, like I said, other than the introduce, cite, and explain. We don't have anything we have to use like that in our standards. We just have to teach. We just have to teach the writing.
Okay. So, although there's nothing that you have to actually use, do you find that there is one particular way? I mean, you've talked about introduction, cite, explain. Is the one you talked about the body paragraphs and the introduction? I know that the way I teach an introduction with a literature essay is to turn around and kind of, it's like your thesis statement. It's tell the examiner what it is you are going to be talking about within the essay itself. And it also use that as a kind of, I say to them that it's a reminder. So if you kind of forget what you're writing about, you can always go back to that opening paragraph and say, you know, that's what I'm supposed to be talking about. And then you talked about, I think, the body of the paragraph before reaching into that conclusion. So in terms of the thesis statements, and I know that you said that it isn't something that you have to do, but how would you get the students to write a defining, a really good kind of opening statement?
Okay, well, we start our process where my sophomores, my 10th, you know, my 10th graders, my year 10s, they are working on a research paper right now.
Yep.
And so the first thing, we just started with them brainstorming, looking up topics, honing, you know, so they've got that. And then I had them, so what they turned into me earlier this week was their three-point thesis. So I have them structure, when you talk up, so they're doing a three-point thesis, and that is the roadmap to the rest of their paper. And so once their thesis is approved, I have them create either a graphic organizer or an outline to structure their paper. And we talk about what they're going to put in for their hook, what are they going to use for background information? How is that going to lead to your thesis? Point one of your thesis is, you know, start your first body paragraph. That may lead to two, that's fine, but that's your first point. That's your, you know, your first body point. And then, so we always, like you said, we always go back to the thesis to structure the rest of our paper. But I have them, I'm grading their outlines this weekend before they really start writing their paper. So just this week, they started working on their introduction, but that's not until we had the whole framework of the essay mapped out for them.
Okay.
So I guess that's,
yep.
All I was going to say is, so like I said, I don't use necessarily like a raft or point evidence analysis, but I do set up a definite, do have them set up a definite structure.
Okay. So one thing that kind of stood out for me, it's one thing I've never actually thought of using, is that you said that part of the process is having a graphic organizer kind of thing. How would you do that? How does that work?
Well, so before we ever, you know, so one of the things we do, like I said, they start working on like their thesis statement. Gosh, they started working on like a couple of weeks ago. And so then they started doing research. So they have like all of their sources. So they have four sources that they have to use for this research paper. They've already annotated them. They've already taken notes. They know what information they think they want to put into their paper. So they have all of this background knowledge on their topic. Yeah. And then they have to build, like I said, either a graphic organizer where they just are chunking the information and trying to put it into that structure before they start writing. And this way, so they kind of, they start to, yeah, so they start, so like I said, they've been working on their thesis this whole time, molding mm-hmm. their thesis, figuring out what works, what, you know, what they can put in, what they can't put in. I've been looking at them and approving them and sending them back, you know, to work on them more as they do research. So they're building that thesis mm-hmm. as they're doing the research. And now when they build their outline or their graphic organizer, whichever they choose, they are starting to chunk the information together into the three parts of the body. So I don't necessarily say it's each body paragraph because I want them to do more than three body paragraphs, but each part in the outline where they're going to chunk that information in order to answer that thesis or provide support for that thesis.
Okay, cool. That's cool.
So that's how I kind of chunk all that together. But again, not until they get done with all of that do they actually like put pen to paper and start writing their paper.
Right. So in terms of the graphic organizer, because for me, graphic is pictures. So when they're chunking all that information together in the graphic organizer, do they use pictures, symbols and stuff as well to help them?
Well, some of them could. I don't know. I haven't had any of them do that in the last like year or so. Some of them, I don't care if they do. I want them to, however they can visually put their paper together before they start writing so that they can see kind of what their paper is going to look like when they're done. Yeah. And obviously that's not, you know, because I want them, because you know how it is. I mean, you look at that blank computer screen or that blank piece of paper, it's, you know, and you're sitting here going, okay, now what am I going to write? How am I going to do this?
Yeah, it's the scariest thing in the world.
It is. But if you have something down, whether, and when I say graphic organizer, I guess like in this, you know, we think of a graphic organizer as like circles and squares with things in them to help separate.
Okay.
And it's just a, it's just a different visual look at a paper. For us, it's kind of the same thing as an outline, but it's just more visually appealing.
So it's kind of like, boxes, like boxes of information around a central point, so to speak.
Yes. Okay. You can say it's similar to like maybe a, like it could, you can kind of liken it to a Venn diagram, but you generally don't have the boxes intersecting each other.
Okay. Brilliant. Right then. So I am going to come back and pull your mind apart a little bit more in a second, but we're going to go to the news first. I'll see you in a second.
Okay.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news, is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests, that pupils can come in their pyjamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Burwell Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Burwell Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey, by Teacher Tap, asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
And welcome back to the Late Late Show with Sean Mackay and Katie Prangy. I think I've got that right this time. And we've just been talking about everything writing in terms of academic writing, and we're on to how to how to structure an essay writing. So, Katie, one of the things I wanted to talk about now is you talked about background information. What do you mean by background information? I mean, I think I know what it is, but I'm kind of unsure. What would that be?
Okay, so in an introduction, we have the hook, you know, what draws the reader in, and then background information to give the reader a little bit of context about what is leading up to the thesis. And so I try to have my students focus on general information about the topic versus specific, not things that can be included in the body paragraphs. So it's mostly a bridge between the hook and the thesis, to give a little bit of meat, a little bit of weight to what the reader is going to experience through the essay.
Okay, so in any of the points that you've made, that kind of brainstorming, the thesis, the graphic organizer, the background information, do you kind of have students that try to miss stages of that, and can you tell if they've missed any of those stages or that they've skipped it or that they've kind of gone a little bit less information or less in depth than you would like to?
Oh, well, like I said, throughout the whole process of writing, I have checkpoints. So as they're doing, they have a whole packet that they do. So they're brainstorming. They have to turn that into me, and I look at that. Their thesis statements, all iterations of it, they have to turn that into me. They have to go through a source checklist and show me what sources they are going to use, and they have to create the citation for them in a program we call Noodle Tools. Don't ask me why it's called that. I have no clue. But anyway, they also, you know, so they create an outline. They turn that into me. And I just conferenced with several students yesterday who have not done some of those steps. I have students who don't have their sources. I have students who have not completed their outline. And yet they're still trying to work on, they're still trying to work on their intro paragraph. And I say, no, I'm not even going to look at that until you get these other steps done first. So I will not grade a process unless the other ones are completed.
Right. So it's essentially check again. And if they haven't completed any of that stage, then you're essentially just sending them back and saying, I don't care how much you've done, you haven't shown me this stage yet. And so it's, I'm trying to think of the right word. It is making sure that the students are following each step of the process. And if they don't, there is kind of a consequence. And that means that they have to go back and redo it.
Correct, because writing is a process. That's the whole point, is that it is a process, and it's a recursive process that, you know, once they start, like I said, once whatever they put down first on their paper is not generally not what they end up turning in. And so I want them to learn that it's okay to go back, that it's okay to make a mistake and have to go back. But if you have nothing to go back to, then there's no going back. So they have to do the process. That's part of the assessment. And for those who want to take my English 4, that is the process. That's the process I teach in English 4. And for the kids who don't do it, you know, who don't follow the process in English 4, not only do they get poor grades on those steps in the process, they also don't do as well on their essay. And they figure that out very quickly.
So essentially, and I hope I've got this right, because I'm thinking about doing this myself now, that your assessment process, because what we do in the UK is we go through all of the bits and pieces and we have a certain set time with which we have to do it. And then it's the essay only that we mark. And that's the only thing that we actually give a grade for. But are you saying that you mark and assess, part of that assessment process is the whole thing? The kind of like you are looking at each step and they gain marks and an assessment kind of credits, so to speak, for each part of that process.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And the way I have my rubric set up is they get points for their pre-writing. They get points for having their sources annotated and notes taken on them. They get points for doing the peer editing of each other's papers. They get points for doing the revision work, because that's all part of the process. Now, the majority of their grade, I will say, you know, the majority of their grade is the final product, but I still give credit for those parts of the assignment.
Okay. Which is absolutely brilliant. I've never actually thought of adding marks for the process of it, so that they actually have to do that process in order to get the higher grade, the higher assessment. Because that way, especially in the younger years, that is certainly going to be something, because if you can teach them that process and get them to stick to that process and give them credits for it, I think that's absolutely brilliant. So moving on to my next question then, and this is about, we've kind of skipped over this a little bit in terms of terminology. How important do you think kind of terminology is when writing an academic essay? I mean, I don't know whether the terminology in terms of what you teach over in America is the same as stuff that we teach in the UK, but how important do you think it is?
Oh, I think it's, depending on what the subject is, I think it's very important. So right now my English 4 students are working on poetry explications. Yeah. And so one of the things we did is we went over the terminology, you know, we went over literary terminology. And I mean, they know a lot of it, like metaphor, simile, you know, hyperbole. But we worked on, we worked on things like speaker versus the poet. And we talked about how the explication is supposed to be structured and what terminology they're supposed to use. And yes, I do think it's really important, because no matter what industry you go into, you have terminology that you have. That specific jargon is the word we use, here. That's industry specific. And so when we are working on things that have a specific jargon or a specific vocabulary, I really try to ensure that they that not only do they know the vocabulary, but they actually use it and use it properly in the paper.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things as a literacy coordinator in my school is trying to get all departments to really push their kind of tier three terminology, jargon, kind of vocabulary within their subject, because it's so important when it comes to answering questions in exams, to understanding the question, because lots of times the questions that are being asked in exams has that kind of, as you said, jargon in it. And if, unless they know that particular terminology, they're not going to be able to understand the question as much. So how do you teach terminology in order to get it into? I mean, I know that we kind of, it's an ongoing process in when I teach it. It's kind of like we're always putting it in there, we're finding it, we're repeating it, reiterating it, what the word is, what the effect is. Is that the same kind of thing that you do?
Yes, yes, it is. And what I find interesting, which is why I like to teach like this explication, is not only do you have to use the terminology and use it correctly, but you really learn how to talk about another piece of writing in terms of, so when we talk about poetry in a piece of writing, we talk about it not in terms of what the poet says in the poem, but what the yep. speaker says and who the speaker is. So using essays like that and assignments like that, students learn how and why, not only learn the vocabulary, but learn why it's important to use it in specific contexts.
Yeah. Do you also find one of the things that I find really hard to teach in terms of terminology, and you use the word poet and speaker as an example yourself, is that nuance of terminology, knowing which word to use and when, or sometimes when not to use the terminology, when to just, you know, go in depth into the exploration of the analysis of the language and not to kind of use or place terminology in it, which is going to get in the way of the analysis that you're doing. I don't know whether that's, you would do that as well.
I do try to do that. That's a really fine line, and that's not an easy thing. That's not an easy thing to teach. Mm-hmm. Students, you know, my seniors start to kind of pick that up, because we talk about, when you first started talking, the first thing I thought of was transition words, you know, yeah. moving from one thing to the other. My students struggle, especially sophomores, and sometimes even at the senior level, using different transition words and figuring out what each transition word means and why this transition word is better to use versus this one.
Yeah.
And so I do try to, when I teach different vocabulary, when I teach how to use it in a paper, I do try to provide examples and explain why sometimes it's better to go this way, or to go, you know, or to use this term, or as you said, to not use it at all and give a further in-depth analysis. Because I also, whenever I teach and whenever we talk about writing, I'm always telling the students, the point of you writing is I want to see your thought process. I want to see what you've learned. I want to see your point, you know, what you believe. Cause we do a lot of political stuff. Cause you know, things here in the States are really crazy right now.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of political stuff. And I always tell students, I don't care like what your opinion.
I think your phone went on blank again.
Okay, sorry. I'm back. Sorry. And no, I was saying, I teach what I strive for my kids, which is why terminology and vocabulary is so important. I don't necessarily, and I don't know if you'll agree with me, I don't necessarily care what their point is or whether they agree or disagree with the reading or whatever. But I care about how they get there.
Yeah.
Yes, and how they analyze it and how they use the text to come up to their conclusions. Because I think students are so afraid to disagree with a teacher. And I'm always like, no, go ahead, disagree with me. I don't care. I just want to see how you get to your opinion. I want you to think for yourself, but I want to see your, I want to see your thought process. Yeah. And so that, and that's where the vocabulary is so important. And that's where putting the words down on the paper in the correct way is so important, because you don't have the, you don't have expressions, you don't have your hand gestures, you don't have any of that. You have your punctuation and your words to get your message across.
No, absolutely. I think it's one of the greatest things a teaching experience is when a student disagrees with you and starts to put their point across and starts to kind of argue with you, because then you can see that they're really engaging in the actual topic rather than just superficially listening and trying to just mimic what the teacher does. It shows that kind of independence and that maybe that something original is going to come out of their writing. But certainly one of the things you've just said there, because I don't know why it just struck a chord with me. It's kind of like, it's one of the things I'm going to say with my kids tomorrow. It's like, you don't have hand gestures when you are writing. And I've just, we move our hands so often in order to express some kind of emotion or some kind of exclamation or some kind of pause, or, and you can't do that in writing. So you have to do it with your punctuation. You have to do it with the vocabulary you're using. I think that's absolutely brilliant.
I talk about that all the time. We, you know, I had, there's this book called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. I
don't, yes.
I think, okay, I have that book and I read from that all the time to students. And I'm like, words matter. Punctuation matters, you know. Yeah. And we have a lot of fun with that. But yeah. I think because I try to reinforce things like that so often with them, that that they really start to internalize that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, repeating things over and over again, I think really makes them think about it. So moving on to my next question. One thing that I've found is that students don't plan for academic writing. And I think we've covered this quite a lot, but I think this bit, how important do you believe, and I think I already know your answer to this one, how important do you think planning is, and how do you teach planning to your students?
Well, I think planning is super, super important. And I teach it through, well, I do, I teach it through modeling, you know, and like I said, and I go through, when I start teaching writing, like I said at the beginning, I teach that it's a process, and I go through the step-by-step process with them. And I show them not only through other examples, like we take other writings, like other essays, like say George Orwell's Shooting an Elephant, for an example, we take that and we go backwards. We go back to the outline. We find the thesis statement, and we go back and we create an outline. And so we take the finished product and then we go backwards in the process. And I do that with a lot of different writing assignments for them. And then so that they can more easily go forward in the writing process.
I think that's great. I know what you mean. The finding an essay and a question which someone's answered and then going backwards, I think, is a great idea. It's something I haven't actually done yet. Really stupidly, considering I've been a teacher for 21 years, but I've never gone backwards through someone else's essay and looked at the process that they've done and gone back through what they've said and deconstructed it, so to speak. I think that's a great way of looking at it and a great way of doing it, because it's a great way of modeling the process and showing how an expert does it.
Well, and I never thought about doing that until I read Laura Hillenbrand's, I think that's how you say her last name, her book Unbroken. And yep. I listened to an interview that she did on CBS Sunday Morning, and she talked about her writing process. Yeah. And so I show that every year too. And I was like, wait a minute, I bet you I could go backwards. Cause she talks about how she does, you know, how she finds her novels and how she writes and her whole which was fascinating. But that's what spurred me to kind of think about going backwards and trying to understand how someone got to a finished product, obviously with things much shorter than novels, but
yes. I think that's absolutely a good way of looking at planning creative writing as well. It's just something that I'm thinking about myself, because obviously I have to do creative writing. So planning it from, so what, how does it end? And then planning it backwards to the beginning might also be a good way of looking at it. Which is going to lead me, sorry, carry on.
I was going to say that would be super cool with like short, short suspense stories, I just think that'd be a really cool thing to do with a lot of short writings. Now you got me thinking.
That's good. So leading me back into my final question for you then. So we've talked about a lot, and I'm going to summarize it at the end. If you could give one then piece of advice about how to teach writing, what would it be?
I would honestly say to do it in small chunks. Don't give kids the whole, I mean, I give kids an overview of the assignment, but I think the fact that I break it down into smaller chunks makes it easier for kids to complete the, you know, complete the process. I have smaller, you know, short due dates, smaller chunks, and that's what we do in my department for all of our major writing assignments. And so, like I said, breaking it down into their parts or their components.
Okay, brilliant. I like the smaller due dates, I think is quite good. So not just chunking it in terms of over maybe three lessons, but doing a specific small bit and then having them submit that to you so that you can assess it and then giving it back, and then they do the next stage. Because often I think we are so, as teachers, so condensed in the amount of time, because time is so precious, that we have to get everything done in such a short period of time that we just don't assess that small bit that we've done. And I think that's quite good, you know, giving them a due date to get that first part of the process done, and then assessing it and then doing the next bit, I think is great.
No, it is. And I think for most students, I mean, you're going to have, like I said earlier, you're going to have your kiddos who don't follow that process. But like, yep. You know, but there is a consequence to not doing that. A, they get, you know, they get points taken away. Mm. Plus they end up with a lesser product at the end by not following the process and putting their ducks in a row.
Yes. A fantastic evening. So I'm going to just kind of summarize what I think we've talked about tonight. Definitely reading is the key to writing, and especially reading the same sort of essays and materials that you're going to actually look at and write. You said that it's a process to writing. That is the most important thing, and making sure that you take those steps going through it. You talked about kind of structure in terms of academic writing, and the level of language is the difference between that and creative writing, I think. The structure that you use is kind of a brainstorm followed by that 3-point thesis, your graphic organizer with the background information, but assessing it in each portage would go along. And then you talked about terminology being extremely important, but to be able to use it correctly. And the backwards, going backwards, modeling and going backwards in the planning stage to make sure that they understand the process and how to do it, and repeating that process so that it is internalized. And your best piece of advice is to teach writing in small chunks, to break it down and set small due dates so that you're assessing the process as you go along, so that everyone is following that definite process. Is that kind of what we've got tonight?
I think so. I think that's about it.
Brilliant. Right, Katie, it has been an absolutely amazing evening talking to you. I've got so many notes down. It's kind of like I've got like 5 pages worth of notes I've been scribbling away as we've been going along. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you, especially even with the kind of the gap and waiting for each other to kind of finish before the next person goes along. But it's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you ever so much for talking to us tonight. And I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Well, thank you. I hope you do too. And it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed the last hour.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. So that's it for this evening on Teachers Talk Radio. We're back in a few weeks where we're going to be talking about neurodiversity and writing, and hopefully you'll join me for that too. But until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.